Give me land, lots of land. That's what we want. Well, maybe it's what we need. Our cities, on and on they go. They're spreading out into the far blue yonder. Now, that seems a less than ideal situation for many respects. And when it comes to that vexed issue of housing supply and affordability, all space, land, that's sort of the final frontier. What, though, what if we build denser, smarter, rather than outer, if you see what I mean? Andrew Nimmo, I think, can help here. Now, he is an architect with Lars Nimmo, president of the New South Wales chapter of the Institute of Architects. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
This is a big thing. Our major cities, land values, driving up housing prices. It's a shortage that does that. That's a critical issue.
It is a shortage, but the old approach of simply more urban sprawl for more single detached houses that are further and further away from where people work and where people go to school is not the solution. It's no longer sustainable, and we really have to seriously look at increasing our density.
There's a real mind switch in that, isn't there, because it's the block of land, the backyard.
Oh, there is. I mean, the Australian culture is attached to the idea, and Australian suburbia has some wonderful mythology attached to it, and we all understand that. But we also need to look at the size of Sydney and its comparable cities around the world, and we know that it just can't keep growing. If we want to keep Sydney the same size or to get smaller, then that's fine. Everyone can stay in their suburban house.
Melbourne has the same issue.
Melbourne has the same issue.
All our cities.
And Brisbane is getting there as well. I think once you're getting to that size, there has to be an alternative. Now, it doesn't mean everyone goes into an apartment, but it has to be a big part of what we're building as new housing.
Is there ever been any kind of work done on looking at cities, looking at the existing sprawl of our urban areas, and how much more could be utilised out of that? What sort of increase of density might mean in terms of increased population?
Yeah, look, both Sydney and Melbourne, by world standards, are very low density, extremely low density. Parts of them are high density. I mean, Potts Point and Ultimo are quite high density, but on a whole, they're very low density, which means that we can fit more people within the existing footprint. And that doesn't mean destroying existing suburban neighbourhoods. There are lots of brownfield sites, which are, they might be old industrial areas that have served their purpose. It could be excess government land, excess military land. And, of course, areas around commercial hubs and transport hubs. That's where you want people, because if you get them close to transport, then they can get to where they work.
And once we, though, get across that hurdle, once we start to build a bit more up and a bit more densely, there's even stuff that we can do within that which is going to make things more affordable. I mean, the assumptions we make about what residential accommodation offers,
yes,
build in a lot of cost.
Yeah. I think also another point to make here is high density or even medium high density doesn't necessarily mean high rise. And I think a lot of people assume it does. There are lots of examples, I mean, cities like Copenhagen, which aren't high rise but are high density. You can do it with that mid-rise, you know, your 4 to 6 to 8 story high. And that sort of scale keeps you in touch with the street. I think that's something which with high rise building, there's a detachment. You drive into the basement car park, you come up through the lift, you might never actually go to the footpath.
What about within those sort of accommodation units there too?
Yeah.
How do we simplify there? Because that's an important thing, especially when we're starting to talk about entry-level property for people out of the market.
It's interesting. If you look at the cost of housing and you sort of break up all the components to see where the costs are, one of the issues, which is pretty obvious, I mean, apart from land cost, is the size of the building. So if it's 100 square metres and if it's 120 square metres, an extra 20 square metres is obviously going to cost more money. So if you can reduce the size of the housing, then clearly it's going to be cheaper. But it's very important, how do you do that? If you simply reduce the size of each individual room, all you're doing is making housing that's maybe not terribly comfortable or very nice to live in.
I've got a bold proposal.
Yes.
Why don't we not have full bathrooms for each bedroom?
Now, that was just where I was going to get to. And I think this is where the marketing people have to stand back a little bit. A two-bedroom apartment, why does it need two bathrooms?
Mm.
It doesn't need two bathrooms. Marketing people will tell us that that helps it to sell, and it may well. But if we're talking about entry-level housing, affordable housing, that's outside of that market that they're talking about. And if you take one bathroom out, you've immediately removed $15,000, $20,000 from the cost of the building. Now, that's substantial. The other one is, you know, in the 60s and the 50s, we had communal laundries. Not everyone had their own laundry. Again, for entry-level housing, there's nothing wrong with that as an option, and it saves money.
Well, not more than nothing wrong with it. In for example, a small, medium-density, lowish rise community of maybe half a dozen apartments, to have that sense of communal space, mm. that place where people do come together.
Yeah, it is nice.
It's a bonding thing. Yeah.
And we've lost that a lot in the modern apartment, where we have everything self-enclosed within our own little walls, and you don't meet the other people. The other one we have to look very, very closely at, and this is aligns with the issue of transport infrastructure, is car parking.
Mm.
Underground car parking is very expensive. Now, if we reduce the need for the amount of car parking, and this is sometimes locked into council plans and
DCPs. Very much, and driven by residents around developments often who don't want to lose access to their own car parking in the streets.
That's right. There's a perception that the streets will get clogged and all the on-street car parking will be taken up. But we need to acknowledge that a lot of young people these days are actually choosing not to buy cars, not to have cars. And if there is a reasonable alternative being trains, buses, light rail, whatever, so that they can use public transport, then they can actually go without cars for quite a substantial time into their life.
Mm.
Now, if they don't have cars, why do you need an underground car park? The other thing that I'd like to push is that we decouple the car park ownership from the apartment ownership, so that when you bought an apartment, if you had to say, right, I'm buying my 2-1-3-bedroom apartment, now I have to make a decision, will I buy an underground car park as well? People might stop and think and go, well, no, maybe that extra $50,000 or $60,000, I'll hold on to that, and they might choose not to. But when it's just bundled into the apartment, you kind of almost feel like you're getting it for free. You're not really aware of its cost. And I think making people aware of the cost of these things might actually affect their behaviour.
We've thrown away the second bathroom. We've got a communal laundry. We've bought a bike instead of the car park. And we're seeing what that does with Andrew Nimmo. He's president of the New South Wales chapter of the Institute of Architects, looking at affordability and how to free up some land here on Blueprint for Living. And Andrew, I want to know what nightingales have got to do with this.
Now, Nightingale is this wonderful model that's come out of Melbourne. It's led and organised by architects, and it's specifically looking at the problem of affordable entry-level housing. Now, again, they've done exactly what I was talking about, where you look at the whole spectrum of what makes up the cost of the apartment. Yep. And then they've had a look at where can we make the savings. And certainly they've looked at things like getting rid of the extra bathroom, getting rid of the private laundry, getting rid of the car parking, but they've also getting rid of the marketing. I mean, that's a big component of the cost, and it doesn't add anything to the quality of the housing. It simply ups the sale value.
Well, that's often attached to the way in which we develop spaces. We sell things off the plan. We try to raise money as we go. The marketing is a very important element of that.
Mm. So they've got a great model where you apply and you get into a waiting list. They've got a very strong waiting list, a very secure waiting list, which means they don't need to market it. They've already got the people who are going to move in.
Okay.
Which also means that they don't have much trouble with getting money. Financiers are quite happy to give them the money because it's a very
secure.
You have
this waiting list, it's all going to happen.
That's right. The other thing is, and I think this is particularly the case in Sydney of all places, where the capital gain on housing is going crazy. Just for simply buying something, you can earn enormous amounts of money. Now, it's time that we probably say, well, if we're talking about the affordable housing market, we need to cap how much profit you can make on it to try and keep that housing within the same pool. And that's what they do at that Nightingale. So there's a pre-agreed maximum price you can get if you decide to sell out.
And what does that do to price? I mean, can you give us an example in one of those Nightingale projects of what we can walk into property, you know, at what cost?
Oh, you're getting me on some details here. look, they're in the $300,000 to $400,000 mark.
Okay, which is...
But Look, that's getting into a detail, okay, but
into that ballpark, which suddenly makes that accessible as a first entry into that housing market.
And that's what you have to see it as. It's not, I think, once you're in the market, once you perhaps are a bit older and you've got a more secure income and a better income, okay, that you can go into the overall market and you can compete in that free market. But that entry level, the free market doesn't quite work for you, and there needs to be other ways of getting people into housing.
You say that the Nightingale Project's architect-led, and I'm wondering, you know, what potential there is for driving some of these ideas from the sort of the professional point of view of, and it may well be a good opportunity. There may be good commercial opportunities in being clever about it, not doing the development which maximises return, which perhaps maximises occupancy instead. There are sort of different ways of seeing.
Well, I think you need to start looking at affordable housing or social housing as not-for-profit. Now, there are lots of different providers out there. Nightingale is one option. They're a really interesting option because they're committed to really high-quality architects and doing really high-quality architecture, so that's fantastic. They've got a model which goes from the beginning to the end and beyond, which is great. So, there are lots of different ways of doing it.
So a community-based organisation that works not-for-profit, that nonetheless employs the best people it can and has sophisticated work and good outcomes, but the basic premise of it is not, as we've always seen, the thing of property development and of maximising that return.
Yeah, and those organisations exist, but we need more of them, and we need innovative models as well. And this is where I think architects can help, because architects, what they do best is think of clever ways to solve problems. So you can give them the same problem, whether it be a housing problem, whether it be a costing problem. They'll pull apart the problem and reassemble it and say, well, how about we look at it this way? And that's what we're good at. And that's why I think Nightingale has stood out as something different from what everyone else is doing. And it's spreading. It's now starting to spread into Sydney. They're trying to get some projects up and going here. I read the other day, I think it's also looking to spread up to Queensland, to Brisbane. And, you know, it's a really exciting model.
That's a brilliant idea with some great impetus. Well, there you go. Architects of Australia, there is your challenge. Solve this problem for us, please. Andrew Nimmo will be on your side if you do. He is president of the New South Wales chapter of the Institute of Architects. His firm is Lars Nimmo, and this is Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green.